Tampa Bay Lightning two games away from winning the Stanley Cup, but we have a feeling Dallas still has plenty to say about it before we get there. Good afternoon. Welcome to Hockey Central. Jeff Merrick alongside Brian Burke and Anthony Stewart. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman joins us at the bottom of the hour. Elliot Friedman moments away here on the program. But Berkey, Stewie, gentlemen, good day. Victor Hedman with 3 points yesterday, but the story was Steven Stamkos. In the scant minutes that he played, scores a goal. It was a nice one, rips it far side. And he became the emotional story for the Tampa Bay Lightning last night. Berkey, how much of a difference would that make up and down the bench?
A ton. And I thought he was great in a brief appearance, but I thought his presence in the game and being a factor in the game and then remaining on the bench was a great lift to their team. And that's one of those sporting moments you're going to remember. You know, 20 years from now, you're going to say, remember when Stammer scored that goal in the, in the finals? It was great to see. Now, as a hockey GM, this goes back to playing injured players. We've talked about it extensively on the air. They're going to wish they'd kept him out for a game if another day off would have made a difference where he could complete a game. Mm-hmm. But last night, it's a great story, and if they go on to win, it becomes legend.
Stewie, you see Stamkos out there, scores the goal, stays on the bench, team support, all of it. What do you think?
Well, this reminds me of the legend of Casey Jones. And for those that don't know, Casey Jones was a horror story for rookies in the OHL. And they said that Casey Jones played for Owen Sound, but he was too big to fit on the bus. So he only played home games and he only played one shift. And his job was to come out and beat up the opposing team's rookies. So going up to Owen Sound on the bus, you're shaking in your boots thinking that this guy, 300 pounds, is going to come in and beat the crap out of you in a short period of time, then exit the game. And that was Stamkos. He came in, he played a couple shifts, 5-6 shifts, but he was pretty effective. But as you can tell, you know, when he came out late in that second period to sit on the bench, something just wasn't right. But this is something movies is made of, and I totally believe that he was the main reason why you know, Tampa Bay got that boost and came out flying and end up winning that game.
You OHL guys are all the same. I heard the same thing from Todd Warner about the Casey Jones legend. But for him, when he played with the Spitfires as a rookie, Casey Jones existed in North Bay with the Centennials. And that's who was going to come headhunt the rookies. They're like, all you OHL guys have this identical Casey Jones story from that era, Stewie?
Yeah. For us, it was Owen Sound because it was about a four-hour bus ride. So it's 4 hours you're sitting there. You're sitting there freaking out thinking this guy can't even fit on the bus. So he only plays home games. It was hilarious.
You OHL kids, man. You kill me. All right, Victor Hedman, Berkey, 3 assists yesterday and just... Like, I know that Roman Josi wins the Norris as the defenseman of the year, but is there a better defenseman in the world today than Victor Hedman?
Nope. Not even close. I love Roman Josi. I love John Carlson. We've got some great defensemen in our game, especially some young great defensemen. But right now, he's the best defenseman on the planet, not just in North America.
What does he do right? Like, from a GM's point of view, like, you watch this guy, and you've seen, I mean, Berkey, the one thing we know about you is, I mean, you go out of your way to bring in defensemen. What do you see in Hedman?
Well, I think he's a hybrid. I think he's, first off, you can't beat him. It's like trying to get around a giraffe. And like, one of his parents might be a giraffe, for all I know. And so you start with that. But for a guy who's 6'6", who has elite skating ability, What he's allowed to do, and I thought in game one he looked very mortal, very human after the way he'd played prior to that. And then in game two and game three, you saw the real Victor Hedman come back. Yeah. He can take chances and join the rush and make things happen and still get back because he can beat forwards back up the ice.
Stewie, quick thought on Hedman, free just standing by.
Yeah, but what I like about him, he's playing 25, 28 minutes, and they're easy minutes because you'll see him now. He'll be sitting back, and then all of a sudden in the third period, he'll just jump in the rush. And you saw last night when the game got out of hand, you know, Dallas is taking runs at guys, and he's swatting away like flies. Someone tried to take a run at him, and he barely even moved. So he's not an easy target out there. So he checks all those boxes for a super elite defenseman. And in my opinion, he's the Conn Smythe runaway favorite right now.
Outstanding player. All right, Elliot Friedman from Hockey Night in Canada and 31 Thoughts joins us. So, Fried, this was a snapshot of my life last night. So, I've got two boys, and I'm with my youngest, my 2012. He's got a baseball game in Newmarket, and we get home before the game begins, game three, and TJ, who's my 2010, plays Markham Waxers, where Steven Stamkos is legend. I mean, they have like... they have an audio announcement that Stamkos does before Markham Waxers' AAA game. This is Steven Stamkos, Waxers hockey, whatever it is. So I get in the front door, and the first thing my kid says to me is, Stamkos is playing. Like, it's this emotional charge for the kid. And it seemed as if that went all the way down the bench with the Tampa Bay Lightning. Friedrich was only a few shifts, but that was a huge impact by the captain of the Tampa Bay Lightning last night.
Well, it was definitely a jolt of adrenaline, and you could see it. Like, one of the good things about, you know, being on for a full pregame show is that you get to watch the warm-up, and, you know, we're watching the camera that's down the hallway of the behind the Tampa Bay bench, and all of a sudden you see Stamkos coming down it and how wired he was and how excited, you know, the players were to see him. And it definitely added a charge to the broadcast, the night, the whole event. And, you know, I think you can always tell how much a player is liked by the reaction when he scores. And when he scored last night, you know, first of all, the guys on the ice, they almost clobbered him. They were so excited. And then you saw the reaction of the bench. Those players, they got up when they saw that Stamkos was streaking down the wing and he was going to have a chance to shoot. And their reaction when they scored, when he scored, I mean, you can tell how popular a teammate he is. And, I don't know if he's going to play again. I suspect he may not, but it doesn't matter. He's left an indelible imprint on the 2020 Stanley Cup final, no matter what happens.
Berkey?
Well, Friedrich, I listened to you on NHL Network this morning. I always do. This is really annoying. I have to listen to you twice today.
hopefully, by your standards, I'll be better the second time than the first.
Berkey, I spent 2 hours with Elliot this morning recording a podcast. How do you think I feel?
Oh, 31 turds?
That's the one, baby.
What's going on?
Apple Podcasts.
So, Friedrich, you talked about it this morning, but it's a different audience. Bring us up to date on the Florida-Pittsburgh trade, please.
Yeah, so Kevin Weeks wasn't wrong. Like, they were talking about this deal. Hornquist for Matheson. And I just think it got out before it was nailed down, Berkey. And, you know, it's funny. There was a story that I was working on last week, and, you know, I was talking to a general manager about it, and he was like, you know, he just said to me in an honest moment, Brian, he said, you have no idea how much trouble this causes us when you get onto these things earlier, when these things get out early. And, you know, I listened and, you know, I understood where he was coming from. And, you know, I actually texted him last night. And he said, see, because that's what I think happened here is I think this deal just got out early. And I think the two teams were preparing to make it, but I just think that not everything was nailed down. And, you know, Pittsburgh had to clear it with Hornquist. And I think... you know, I've written about the insurance concern. Apparently, Hornquist's contract under certain situations is not insurable for injury. And I think Florida was worried about that. As a matter of fact, I know they were. And they had made Pittsburgh aware that they were concerned about that as they were considering the trade. And, you know, because Bill Zito had that situation with Nathan Horton where he signed a 7-year deal and only played one and his contract was not insured. So it was something that they were weighing, but I think the two sides were getting towards agreeing to make the deal, and they just had to iron out these two things, and it got out. And all of a sudden, it's uncontrollable. You've lost control of the narrative and everything with it, and I just think that it blew up the deal. Now, I was told last night that it was likely dead, but again, like, you never know, like, once everybody gets a chance to sit for a day or two and maybe kind of recalibrate, maybe that changes. But I heard Brian last night, more not likely than likely that the deal happens.
Can Stewie, hang on 1 second before you jump in on Fridge. I want to sort of swing this back to the general manager on the panel here, and that's, of course, Brian Burke. When something like that happens, Burkey, when someone like Elliot is, you know, snooping around a story, gets it, the word gets out. In this case, it was Kevin Weeks that was on top of this one, and the deal kind of goes south. Like, what does the general manager do next? And does it necessarily KO a deal like this?
Well, it's annoying. I mean, Elliot's annoying. He comes by it naturally. And, he and I had a couple of set-tos when I was a manager. And I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's a way of life, and it's not the reporter's fault ever. You have a leak somewhere, and it's your fault. It's one of the two GMs' fault that someone learned about this, that talked about it, and you can't blame the reporter. I would never blame Kevin Weeks for going with the story if he's got a legit source. So what we would do is, we would keep the circle as small as possible. So let's use this example. Let's say we're talking about trading Sammy Salo to another team. Well, we wouldn't ask our coach if he liked the deal. We wouldn't ask any of the scouts if they liked the deal until we had a deal, until we were ready to pull a trigger. And I'd say to the other GM, give me 20 minutes or give me 10 minutes. But I'm making this deal, but I just want to double check. So we controlled the message, and it couldn't leak out. And often I would say to the other GM, look, it's me and Bob Murray in this room. The only two who know about this deal are me and Bob Murray. So if this leaks, there's going to be hell to pay. And we would, even with a couple organizations we suspected, we would float a trade and see if it leaked. So this is an internal problem for one of the two teams. It's not Kevin Weeks' fault, and it's not Elliot's fault if he breaks the story.
That's not what you said back when we were fighting with each other.
Yes, I know.
I was going to say, the language has cleaned up since then. That's remarkable. All right, so, Stewie, we're hogging this one. Go for it.
Yeah, feel free to get your Kevin BX chirps in now, too, while you're at it. But is there any update on the Alex Pietrangelo contract talks? And where could you see him landing if it's not St. Louis or Toronto?
And, you know, I believe that it's two trenches. The smart thing I think Pietrangelo did by going public was that it wasn't last minute. You know, when he did it last week, it was still 3 weeks before the free agency. So it leaves time. It's not like it was right up against the end. But I think it's like two trenches right now, Anthony, and you know, Doug Armstrong, you know, he's a tough negotiator. And Alex Pietrangelo's agents, Mark Guy and the people at Newport, they're tough negotiators. And they are, you know, I'm sure they don't want this all out in the public, but they're not afraid of public perception. They're going to do what they think is right. And I think Doug Armstrong has drawn a hard line around 8x8. And St. Louis doesn't do bonuses, and they're going to limit the no trade protection they're going to give them. And I think that Alex Pietrangelo and his agents feel that this has been much harder a process than it should have been for him, that other players on the team have received market value, and he feels he's worthy of a certain value. And that's the way, and he also feels that the negotiations have progressed way too slowly. And I think he's upset. And, you know, so now you've got the emotion, you've got the hard feelings. And, you know, I think that my guess is they're going to take a timeout, which is kind of where they are right now, and they're going to take one more run at this. But I don't know how much everybody's willing to move. Like, when this came out last week, Anthony, a lot of the initial reaction I had was, this is posturing to get towards a deal, smart play. But everyone I've spoken to has told me this had gone legitimately off the rails. Like, it was just not working. So I see a timeout. I see a conversation closer to October 9th and another attempt to try to get it done. But the Blues have had a philosophy, and they don't seem inclined to change it. Now, as for teams out there, I believe that if Vegas is interested, they're going to be a player in this. And But again, like Toronto, if they are interested and it gets there, they're going to have to do things to clear out room to get them.
Okay, would I then be too naive, because the number is going to be the number, the term is going to be the term. If the holdup is the other things, mm-hmm. would I be too naive to suggest that this is about bonus structure and a buyout-proof contract?
I think that has a huge thing to do with it. I mean, you know, if you look at, for example, a contract like Drew Doughty's, and you know, pick your site, whether you're a cap-friendly person or you like Puckpedia, whichever one you like, go on and look at the structure. And Drew Doughty's bonuses are all in the first 4 years of his 8-year deal. And the back end, there's no bonuses. And one of the things I've heard Pietrangelo wants is protection towards the end of his contract that it doesn't get bought out. And I do think, like, you know, someone said to me, structure's an issue, yes. No trade protection is an issue, yes. But even on the AAV, I don't think they're close to each other. I think it's a lot of things, but protection on the back end of the contract, Jeff, is absolutely an issue.
Berkey? Do we have Brian?
Turn on that mic, Berkey.
You might have mute on. We'll see. Well, we'll get Brian back on. Stewie will hand this one.
So sick of listening to me, he just walked away from the radio.
Well, this morning on Sirius 91, that may be one thing, and then a couple of minutes with you. You know, let's stick with. We have Brian back. Brian, go ahead. We're just talking about the Pietrangelo contract structure, bio-proof deal towards the end, etc. Pick it up where you see fit.
Yeah, and I think Elliot's right about the snags, and I think he's right about the timeout. I don't think this is over. I think there's still plenty of time to make a deal. The question is whether the team's going to change its principles. And there are GMs, and I was one of them, Lou Lamoriello was one of them, that will not change their basic structure to accommodate even a star player like Pietrangelo. So it could be a problem. And then what we always said internally is, okay, if we were willing to go 8x8, we just got that back in our wallet. That we got that money to spend on other free agents that won't cost us eight times eight. So anyway, Elliot, Ottawa says they're not going to qualify Craig Anderson. This seems to be a trend that's going to turn into a river. You've already seen it with Mikko Koivu. You've already seen it with Alex Galchenyuk. I think there's more of this coming.
Well, the first buyout window opens tomorrow. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see what kind of happens here. It is going to be really interesting to see who gets qualified and who doesn't. Like, I think there are teams threatening players that they won't qualify. And I think they're just saying, like, if you don't agree to this, you're going to be gone. And now it's a situation where some players are going to weigh it out and say, okay, do I want the security or do I think this is a bluff? Like, I think Vancouver's been kind of doing that with Vertanen and Stetcher. Like, we can't afford your QOs. We can't afford the arbitration. You know, what are you guys willing to do? And now the card game is on to figure it out. I think Edmonton's doing that with Athanasiou. They can't afford. They're not really crazy about his QO or his arbitration possibilities. So they're trying to see if they can work something out. I'm curious about when it comes to buyouts, a player like Nashville and Kyle Turris. Are we going to see a buyout there? I'm less inclined, Berkey, to believe right now that Marc-Andre Fleury is getting bought out. I don't think Vegas wants to do that. But I think it's going to be interesting. I think the next couple of weeks are going to be fascinating from a business perspective, because I think teams have been kind of waiting and saying, okay, who's going to be available that maybe we didn't think is going to be available? Or who's going to be available and looking for the right fit to resume their career? Like, I think a guy like Turris is going to be interesting. It just didn't work in Nashville with him. For whatever reason, it just didn't work. But I could see a bunch of teams saying that, you know, Kyle Turris is better than he showed there. and with a new situation, he rediscover himself. I could see a player like him, depending on what he wants, having quite a bit of interest because he's a center.
Stewie.
We're going to have Gary Bettman on in a little bit here, and I'm sure this question is better suited for him. But when do you think next season's going to start, and do you see any potential bubble scenario being a viable option for this next year?
You know, he did a State of the Union address before game one last Saturday, and I don't think we're going to see a bubble, Anthony. I don't think the players want it. I don't think the owners want it. You know, I can't see that happening. I really can't. I thought it was interesting that, kind of unsolicited, he said that maybe next year we start with no fans, as long as we know at some point we can graduate to fans. Like, the phrase, and I've used this a million times, I've heard, is a path toward attendance. The owners want to know there's a path towards attendance. Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, was on CNN the other day, and he said he thinks it's likely January before they play. And I generally think the two sports have similar timelines. You know, so I think it's going to be January, maybe February. And I think that he and the owners are going to have to know that there's a path toward attendance. But I'll tell you, Anthony, I'd be shocked if there were bubbles. I just don't see the players or the owners wanting it.
One of the things that I'd like to get into at the bottom of the hour, as you sort of promote that the commissioner is coming up here in about 8 minutes' time, is what stays. You know, there was the nature of sports is it sort of marches to a certain inevitability, but that takes a few years. And I think what the COVID situation has brought upon us, and this is true of life as well, it's sort of hit fast forward. And where we thought we were going to be 3 years from now, we're there now. And I'm curious, Elliot, if there's anything that you look at right now with the game, either in the way it's presented, the way it's played, anything around the game, that you look at and you say, you know what, we were probably going to get there eventually, but now we're there and it's going to stay.
You know, to be honest, I was thinking about this, Jeff. I don't know the answer to that question. You know, we've all wondered if the days of, you know, dressing room access could be over. And the commissioner is on record a couple of times, and he said again on Saturday that that's not going to be the case. I think they've done an incredible job. I really have. I think the bubble life has been really hard on people, really hard on people. And the players, the coaches, the executives, the workers, everybody who's in there, I think it's been extremely difficult, and they deserve a ton of credit for the show they've put on despite that. I think the product has been much better than I thought. But when I look at what you're saying, Jeff, like, how much of this would you like to see continue?
None.
You know, and Berkey, I think that might be the right answer. And it's nobody's fault.
You know what? Just and it might be just a small television thing, but some of the presentation I really enjoy.
Like you're talking about the camera angle?
The overhead shot on power plays.
Oh my God,
I love.
Ron might charge into the studio and kill you. Like every time that angle comes up, he's like, stop that.
I love it.
Good year, blimp view.
as a viewer, I love that one. I really do.
I don't.
And Berkey and Anthony, you sitting in that green room there, you know how Ron feels about it. But you know, I look at this and I say they have done an unbelievable job, and I think I'm probably like most people, like I never want to see this again.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that survives is you're going to see a different schedule next year if we play. And if we play to no fans, then a pathway to fans. So let's say January, no fans. February 15th, we do socially distanced fans with a cap on how many people can attend. And we work our way up to, and at some point the vaccine comes into play. But, you know, from my perspective, given the revenue loss on the team side, we're going to see different travel now. We're going to see more back-to-backs.
I agree
You're
with
not,
that.
Yeah. Calgary's not going to go to Vancouver four times next year. They're going to go twice. They're going to play two games.
And I think that's why I think the goalie market this year I think with all the choices available, because you know you're going to have two goalies next year and two goalies who can really play, because you're going to be playing a lot of back-to-back and 4 and 5. I agree with you, Berkey. I think, and teams are preparing for that to happen. You know what, Jeff, here's something for you. And I would be curious, Brian as an executive and Anthony as a player. I think people really liked afternoon playoff games this year.
Yep.
Would you want that?
Selfishly for
well,
me, yes.
As a former player, no. I mean, yeah. I thought afternoon games are terrible. It screws up your meals, your nap, the whole thing. I love early games. I love like 5 o'clock games.
Okay.
Well, remember, a lot of these guys played in the AHL, right? So they're used to those afternoon games. And I'm the wrong guy to ask, because I'm just, I love eating breakfast and lunch at the same time. So I don't mind those afternoon. I don't mind those afternoon games at all.
Let's cut it up.
Maybe that's the question. Like, Berkey, what, like, and one of the reasons teams don't like those games is that revenues tend to be lower. You don't sell as much alcohol, for example, at 5 o'clock, or especially like at 1 o'clock than you normally would for a 7 o'clock game. But mm-hmm. what if our schedule during the playoffs was Eastern time, 4, 8, and 10?
Berkey, would you like that?
Yeah, look, we got to do what's best for the revenue side of the game. If that means we play games at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we play two games at 2 o'clock.
We got to cut it off. Sorry, guys. The commissioner standing by here in a couple of moments. Gary Bettman joins us on Hockey Central. Good stuff, Friege, but you're getting bumped for the commissioner. Sorry.
That's a joke.
Thank you, Elliot.
All right, guys. Take care.
Be well. Elliot Friedman from Hockey Night in Canada and 31 Thoughts. Let's get out quick and on the other side. Gary Bettman, NHL commissioner, joins us. Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We're back in a moment. Back to the program here Monday to Friday starting at noon. It's Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Jeff Merrick alongside Brian Burke and Anthony Stewart. Gary Bettman is the commissioner of the National Hockey League. It is 2-1 Tampa in the Stanley Cup final as we welcome the commissioner to the broadcast. And many were skeptical. Gary, I was one of them. I always maintain I really hope that I'm wrong. And thankfully I am, because here we are in the Stanley Cup final. We have spent so much time talking about what bubble life has been like for the players. I'm curious, Gary, what's it been like for NHL people in the bubble?
Well, Jeff and Brian and Anthony, it's good to be with you, but I'm going to ask you a question first. Why were you skeptical? Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that any sports would be played this summer, to be honest with you. I had a hard time rationalizing a path here.
Not a chance.
Oh. Well, I hope we didn't disappoint you.
The difference was, Gary,
happy
as I've said, I said we'd cancel the season, and what you guys did, which was really smart, is say, well, it doesn't have to be June. We'll just build some runway. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And you know, Brian, as well as anybody, it's all about execution and detail. We decided that we needed, because our fans and our players are telling us they wanted a conclusion to the season that they had all invested in emotionally, in terms of their own commitments professionally, and people wanted closure. And I thought it was incumbent upon us to consider every option, every possibility, and maintain the agility and flexibility to adapt and react to whatever the circumstances were. And that's how this all came about. Getting to your question about how it has been for NHL people who on the ground put this together, it's been nothing short of remarkable. Under Steve Mayer's leadership, we had, between the bubble in Toronto and the bubble in Edmonton, 150 people who were up here working, focusing on every little detail to make this as safe as possible, which was the first priority. Health and safety was paramount, and make it as comfortable as possible. I believe the two teams, Dallas and Tampa, that are still competing have probably been in the bubbles for 63 days. I've had staff here for 2 weeks longer than that, and what really makes what they did remarkable was when they got on planes to go to either Toronto or Edmonton, they were going into the general population initially. They had to set up the bubbles that were in place and provided the safety and comfort that we were going to have. And what they did was truly, truly remarkable. And it's also a testament to the provinces of Ontario and Alberta and to the Canadian government that the COVID-19 was in such a state here that while I waited to the last second to make the decision, and some people criticize it, we went to the places where we could be the safest because the communities were safer than perhaps anywhere else in North America.
Stewie, go ahead.
Well, I'll go on record, Gary, by saying I was the only one on this show to predict that the season would continue, and I also predicted that there'd be two Canadian bubbles. So that's moving on.
Well done, Stewie.
I'm glad there's somebody on this show who's insightful.
So up to this point, the NHL's had zero positive COVID tests. So is that something that you guys crossed your fingers and hoped for, or was that something you were anticipating with this bubble?
You know, actually, that's a great question. And when if you go back and you think about, you know, the various phases, phase one, we asked everybody to go home and isolate when we took the break in mid-March. And the players were sensational in doing that. And then phase two, we opened the training facilities and there was some testing going on. But again, people were doing the right things vis-a-vis socially distancing and isolating to the extent you could. And then when we opened training camps, it was more of the same, and we were testing more regularly. We always believed that if we could get into the bubble, we would have a really good chance of keeping everybody healthy. And I don't want to jinx it because we're not done yet, but it has been a real testament to the vigilance that the players and the other team staffs have adhered to with respect to the protocols that we developed. And this was, you know, the ultimate collaborative effort with us and the Players Association and the players really committing to doing what had to be done to get through this. And what was also great was the shape the players came back in, because for a number of players, when we took the break, my guess is for many of them, they hadn't gone that long without skating since they were toddlers. Mm-hmm. And everybody really gave it their all. It was the ultimate in collaboration and professionalism. But our belief was once we could get to the bubble, we would have our greatest chance of keeping everybody healthy. And as I think everybody knows, we test every day. And we've had over 32,000 tests of our team, teams and team personnel, and there hasn't been a positive test.
Berkey.
Knock on wood. So, Gary, the NHL has always been a leader in diversity and inclusion, ice hockey in Harlem, Mr. O'Ree's Hockey is for Everybody, Mr. Snyder's program, You Can Play. But through this bubble and this hockey, there's been some really strong social justice initiatives by the NHL. Tell us about those.
Well, you know, our clubs and we have done a lot over the last two decades, but this was a good time for reflection based on everything that was going on in the world, and we need to do better. This is about looking forward, not looking back, and it's always been a priority to me that the game, particularly at the NHL level, be diverse, inclusive, and welcoming. And internally, we're setting up a hotline, which is about to be launched, so to make sure that there are no issues that people are not prepared to talk about because they can use the hotline. We're going to be doing training. We're going to be focusing on more grassroots programs. We're going to look to be more diverse in our business dealings and creating a pipeline. And Kim Davis, who I think you all know, who's our senior executive vice president of social impact, is focused on making sure that not only that we have the right agenda moving forward, but that we do the things that are necessary to be better and make a difference. Because ultimately, we want hockey to be welcoming at all levels. But we have to make sure that at the NHL level, we're as good as we can be and even better than we've ever been, and set the right example for the rest of the hockey world at all levels, but also the communities in which we play. And among the things that Kim has worked on for the last few months is setting up an executive inclusion council, which has broad-based representation. And the goals of that council are to set goals and objectives and then hold us accountable for meeting them, making sure we're setting realistic goals and objectives, not just, you know, pulling them out of the air, and making sure that we're going to fulfill the commitments we make to make the game a shining example moving forward. And that's what we're committed to. And my expectation is we're going to deliver on that commitment.
You know, and further to that, Gary, I think that we can all see this game changing and conversations around the game changing. I can remember when we had came on our podcast, you talked about getting comfortable with uncomfortable conversations. And I wonder, you know, including in that conversation, but also from the business of the NHL, how it's presented, how you go about day-to-day business, how much do you think all of this, this COVID situation with your sport has changed the future of hockey?
That is a great and profound question. And I've never been asked it quite like that before. I think in terms of our role in whether it's social justice or making a difference in other ways in people's lives, whether it's Hockey Fights Cancer or our greening initiatives, we need to be as self-aware as possible to make sure that we're standing for the right things and giving people an opportunity to connect to the game in ways that not only makes them feel comfortable, but makes them feel welcome. And using the platform that all sports has to be out there as role models is something that's always been important to me. When you tie in COVID-19, I mean, we're dealing with a world that nobody envisioned. And certainly I hope we never have to deal with again. And my goal is, if you look at it in the very short term, that we get ready for next season, that we have an opportunity to play a full season, regular season and playoffs, that we ultimately be in a position to have fans in our buildings, because our fans are an essential part of our experience. There's a reason that in person we have the best experience, I believe, in all the sports. And a large part of that is the energy that our basically sold-out buildings, we played 95% of capacity in the regular season and over 100% in the playoffs. That's part of the energy of our game. Our fans feel it from each other, and I think our players feel it. Going to the other part of your question, anything we do that's going to make a difference in people's lives really needs our players to be involved. What we do needs to be authentic, needs to be real, and that's where our players have been great in terms of giving of themselves to do and stand for the right things.
Excellent. Stewie.
Gary, I know there's a lot of moving parts, but when do you anticipate next season starting, and do you see any variation of the bubble being a scenario for next year?
Now, Gary, don't blow up on us. We have to ask.
Berkey told me to ask.
Actually, you're asking the really good questions, and, you know, I had a media avail on Saturday, and I think I got asked that question 10 different ways. On the 11th, I said, Bill, why don't you try and answer it, because, you know, I'm not satisfying everybody. The answer to that is we put in December 1st as a notional date. I don't expect it to be December 1st. It's probably going to be later, you know, late December, January. We need to, first of all, finish this season and finish the Stanley Cup Final. Take a deep breath. We have the draft coming up. And then we've got to take stock of what the world's going to look like. And to answer your question is, tell me what COVID-19 is going to be like and where. Where's going to be spiking? Where's going to be safe? Tell me what the Canadian-U.S. border is going to be like. Are we going to be able to transverse it and do it without quarantining? And so there's a lot. Are we going to be able to have fans in our building? And that's not a decision we're going to make. Governmental authorities at all levels are going to make that for us. So there's a lot we don't know. But much like the decision we made to go to Toronto and Edmonton, if you remember, we announced the return to play, and I made those decisions at the last second, and some people were a little critical of that, and I didn't want to make the decisions until I had as much information as possible to know that we were making the best choices. And based on the way Canada, and particularly Ontario and Alberta, have addressed COVID-19, these were really the safest places, perhaps in all of North America, for us to go. The one thing I can say with certainty, we have no expectation that the players are going to be locked in a bubble for 6 months away from their families and friends. That's just not realistic. Doing it for the playoffs was one thing, and I'm grateful and admire their willingness to do it. But at the end of the day, whatever we do can't be that, because it just doesn't work. And so there are a lot of moving pieces, as you said. And what our job is to evaluate all the moving pieces, understand them, understand what our options are to address them, and then at the appropriate time make the best possible decision, and then be agile enough as an organization to be able to deliver on what we decide to do, which is pretty much what we did this time.
Gary, I know you don't feel like taking a victory lap for this, because we're not done, as you mentioned, but this really has been a remarkable achievement by the league and the players. Thanks so much for stopping by today. We always appreciate it.
It's great to be with you guys, and we're looking forward to seeing the Stanley Cup final play out. Thanks for having me. Be safe, stay healthy, and look forward to being with you again.
To you and everyone in the NHL as well. He is the commissioner of the NHL. Gary Bettman has been our guest on Hockey Central. You know, one of the things, Berkey, and you worked with Gary for a number of years. How many years did you work with the commissioner?
5 years.
5 years. So you've seen him in action with owners and bringing in owners and, you know, pretty much almost, I think it's almost everybody, every owner in this league, you know, right now outside of Jeremy Jacobs, is he the only one that the commissioner didn't bring in at this point?
The Wirtz family.
And the Wirtz family. There you go. So it's two, Chicago and Boston. I mean, they've all been brought in by Gary Bettman. So you've seen him work with owners before. One of the points that I always remind myself of when I'm having conversations about the league right now is your point about pay attention to the primary business of each NHL owner and what's happening to it and how that's reflected in their, at times, secondary financial concern, which is their NHL team. How much more difficult do you think, Brian, this entire situation, how much do you think this has complicated Gary's ability to manage 31, soon to be 32 owners in the NHL?
Well, I think the one thing is, I know this even before I left Calgary, the league put in a very extensive credit facility for the teams. So they have funds available if they need them. And some teams had already drawn down on that before I left, and I would never divulge who they were, obviously. But the league made sure that the league was ready for any contingency. But it's going to affect the way teams do business, because I've used Tom Gilardi as an example, the owner of the Dallas Stars. He's in the restaurant and hospitality and hotel business. Guess what? They're in the sewer. And the Pagulas are in the natural gas business. Guess what? They're in the sewer. So the days where an owner could say, well, I lost $10 million on my hockey team, but I made $400 million, those days are gone for a bunch of our owners. So that's impacting on what we do going forward. But Gary's ability to manage the owners, those meetings go like clockwork, trust me.
No, we just lost Berkey. We'll try to get him back here. Stewie, do you have a thought on? I mean, you are the one person, Nick. You are right. You've been consistent with this all throughout. The NHL will be able to pull this off and get through to a Stanley Cup final conclusion. Do you have a thought on how all of this has gone from your point of view?
Yeah, I was just being an optimist, but I didn't really think it could happen. But I don't even think the NHL anticipated zero COVID tests, and we thought positive COVID tests. And we were on the show saying, well, what happens if six, seven teams go down, players go down on a team? What if two goalies go down? And I'm just amazed at the fact that they've had zero positive tests. So, you know, maybe everyone's going Trump and saying the testing is a little bit wonky, but it's an amazing feat that they've insulated this bubble. They kept the players safe. They've kept them healthy. And that's why I always ask, like, if I'm an NHL player and I want to play and keep the business of the league going well and strong, why not look at that possibility next year? And again, I understand the family element. I understand the personal element. But again, we're professional athletes. We get paid a lot of money. And now, you know, I think a lot of these players now have a lot of, you know, empathy for players that have to go over and play in Russia and Finland and Sweden. And they're gone for six, 7 months out of the year, not seeing family or friends. They're doing the Skype. They're doing the movies. And they're in a whole different country where a lot of people don't even speak the language. So I think you get that appreciation where if I'm a player, I'm looking at that bubble life. And again, I'm a father of three. I understand the human element now. But at the business side, too, you got to balance the two. And Berkey is right about one thing, saying, I think the business side is going to be affected greatly. So that's something that I think some, you know, the NHL needs to look at for the upcoming season until we get past this pandemic.
Berkey, we've got you back. You want to finish your thought before we go to break?
Yeah, when Gary calls a vote, he's got the votes counted. It's like a Chicago election in 1960s.
On that, we'll pause. Come back and we'll spend a little bit more time about the game last night as Tampa takes a 2-1 series lead, now two games away from winning the Stanley Cup. And we thank the commissioner for stopping by, Gary Bettman. This is Hockey Central. You're listening to Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the program. Just about 60 seconds here to wind things down. Stewie, we'll start with you. What did we see last night, and what can carry over into Game 4, if anything?
Yeah, we saw the Tampa Bay Lightning get an emotional uplift from Stamkos coming back. They came out, you know, being shot out of a cannon, getting up 2-0 early. But I think for the Dallas Stars, and I mentioned it before the game, they got to stay disciplined. They're taking not necessarily bad penalties, but just penalties at the wrong time. It's a 2-1 game. They get us a 2-1 shorthanded goal to make it 2-1, and then Radulov takes a penalty at the end of the first period, killing all momentum, and then Hedman ends up scoring in the first couple of minutes of the second period. So they got to play a little bit more disciplined game. People are saying maybe we might see some Ben Bishop. I'm not sure, but discipline is key for the Dallas Stars.
Berkey, got about 10 seconds. Can you do it? Your thoughts quick.
Conn Smythe winner for me, Steve Mayer from the NHL.